Sarasota on the sun coast of Florida, slightly rainy day, and we pulled into this motel yesterday. We talked to Milt Gaston yesterday afternoon up there in Bradenton, and came on down this last afternoon. But I was saying, we went west in 78, and I did the very same thing. I wrote letters ahead to about 50 ball players, and I had a letter made up, and I Xeroxed it because it was pretty much the same thing I want to tell them, and sent it ahead, and it didn't work at all. Ted Lyons we got to in Louisiana before the letter did.
Louisiana. Yeah.
And I hadn't really given him enough time, so I think it arrived probably the day or two after. And a couple others didn't remember the letter. Some did. It did work for some. But I found our itinerary was such that I couldn't really keep to a very accurate timetable. I did pretty well in Texas. We got to talk to Nick Tremark, who was in Harlingen, and then Jack Knott and Bib Falk. You may have been his teammate, weren't you, for a while?
I remember Bib Falk, but not too well. But he was a fine ball player, I know. But I remember Ted Lyons very well because I played with him 3 years on the White Sox.
Yeah.
And there was nobody more beloved in all baseball than Ted Lyons, really. Yeah. Wonderful guy.
Yeah, he seemed that way. I didn't arrive kind of late in the day. Didn't get to talk as long as I'd like to have. But he was very congenial right now. And then we got out to Arizona, got a couple interviews there where with Thornton Wade was a good one. Charlie Grimm wasn't very good. He wasn't feeling too well, and he was kind of impatient.
What's surprising, because you'd think he'd be an extrovert and outgoing.
His health was hurting a little bit at that time. I may have caught him at that time. And then in California, we got a few. But we had car trouble in California and had to eliminate some of the places I'd planned to go to. So that kind of hurts. But that was my idea, too. This trip, I haven't done that because it's kind of a short trip. It's a Christmas break here. We didn't know we were going to come until it was rather late. So I thought I'd just take my chances. And happily, I was able to catch people like yourself and Milt Gaston. Bill Terry up in Jacksonville was not able to talk to me, and one or two others were not. But I've been.
He was never exactly friendly to the media. Not that you're media exactly, yeah. But he was always had a bitter war against them. In fact, when I was with Cleveland, I believe it was, in spring training, we went north and we played the Giants over about a period of about 2 weeks, working our way north from spring training in this town and then that town, and finally getting all the way north. So we were with the Giants continually in the same train. We had three cars for the Giant players and three cars for the Whites are the Cleveland players, and car for the reporters and all. And I know he was really against the writers. He didn't even want them associating with his ball players.
Let me just check to see how we're coming in.
Speaking of the three cars, it reminds me of one of Ted Lyons' expressions. He had so many funny ones. When he had three cars for the ball players, he always called one car the appendix car. He said if you cut that one off, it wouldn't hurt the team any.
Could you tell me a little bit about your dad and some stories he's told you about the great old White Sox teams and growing up as the father of a famous ball player like that?
I could, and I'd be happy to, because my remembrances of my childhood and boyhood are just wonderful, and I had a just wonderful father. He was absolutely terrific. Of course, as you know, he was a tremendous ball player, and my dad was very modest, but mother kept a scrapbook, and it was a huge scrapbook. It was about 6 inches thick, and I read articles in there, direct quotes from Ty Cobb, who was the greatest, at that time, the greatest base dealer and one of the greatest ball players of all time, said that my father, and he quoted this, was the greatest catcher that ever stood in shoe leather, which is quite a statement. And but anyway, my dad was a very simple, kindly, wonderful man, with, just a gentle type. It's amazing for the times when he played baseball, ball players weren't quite as, they were a little more rough and ready. And he never drank. He didn't even smoke until my mother bought him a pipe, and then she tried to take it away from him. From then on, he never said any swear words at all. He had a couple of slang things. He'd say, "Holy Mackinac," and "shucks," and things like that. That was, in fact, that reminds me of a story. One time, he was so gentle, he never really got on the umpires that much, but this one umpire was so bad, calling strikes, and Dad was catching them. Dad just looked at him and then walked over and got the whisk broom that the umpires sweep off the home plate with, and got the and swept off the home plate while looking up at the umpire, and threw it over. And the umpire says, "You're out of the game." He threw him out. And Dad said, "Well, I didn't swear at you. That's about all they ever throw you out for, swearing at them." And he said, "Well, that's swearing for you." But he was a tremendous ball player, and he caught almost every game for many, many years at the White Sox. Mm-hmm. When he first went up, if I can go way back, if you'll pardon me, I'll go all the way back. My dad was a country boy growing up in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. And as I say, very simple and uncomplicated, nice type boy. And he started playing, I think, with Cedar Rapids. I'm a little fuzzy about what team was, but I think it was Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And they had some manager named Joe Cantillon there, and he was of the rough and ready type. And they had a dad was just starting out, and he told Dad, there was a man on first and third, and he told Dad, Dad was catching. Dad told Dad not to throw through if that fellow stole. Don't throw to second. Well, Dad had such a good arm, and when that fellow took off for second base, he couldn't resist it. His instincts, he just fired a strike right over second base. Of course, nobody's covering because they weren't expecting to throw and not out to center field. And Joe Cantillon just ripped him up and down, and oh, it was a terrible bawling out. And Dad was so crushed as he just started, you know. And he didn't say anything. He just packed his clothes, and he was down in the railroad depot waiting for the train to go back home. He had just left. And Joe Cantillon was hunting all over for him and found him down there. That might have ended his whole career, right? Yeah, that's odd. But then he went on up to Boston when they only had one league, which was the National League. He caught for Boston. The American League was started, a whole brand new league was started, and he jumped from one league to the other, and he went with the White Sox, and so he was right with the White Sox from the very inception.
Clark Griffith was the White Sox manager that
time? I'm not sure, but Dad had a great regard for Clark Griffith, but I know that in 1906, Fielder Jones was the manager, so I don't know whether Fielder Jones was also the manager then or not.
I think... Ben Johnson, who founded the league, was is from Marietta. He went to our college,
right?
So I've got a great interest in him, and have spent an awful lot of time studying his career.
Mm-hmm.
And when he formed the league, I think Griffith was one of his raiders who went through the National League, too. And I think he was with the White Sox for just a year or so,
Remember that my dad said Clark Griffith had the greatest control of any pitcher he ever caught, which is quite a compliment. Then Dad was there with the White Sox year after year after year, and catching almost all the games. And one thing at that time, which in those early days, the catchers used to have a protector that you blew up with air, you inflated it. And Dad was always fixing punctures in it, and he got tired of having to pump it up each time they got to a new town. And this is not too well known, but he designed, fabricated, and everything, the catcher's protector exactly as it is today, with all the little, those little rolls or tucks that form and follow your body. And he took it to Washington and patented it.
Yeah, right.
And it was called the Sullivan Protector. And he, and then, as always happens, there were other people were trying to infringe on the patents and everything, and he had no time to be trying to combat all these infringements, so he sold the patent to Reach. And it was a, and the only change that's happened in that protector since then, and Bertie Tibbetts started this, was taking off that bottom part because people wear other kinds of protection inside that. But Dad was so proud of that, and he'd show how when you had a vertical seam all the way up and down, that when you put your arm out to catch the ball, that made the protector come out a little and gave you a cushioning effect there. But he caught there, and then in 1906, I think they were in last place in August, and then Hitless Wonders in 1906, very famous team. And the Cubs, of course, were just out, way out ahead in their league, and they were a terrific team, one of the best of all time. And the White Sox were in last place, I guess, and they went on and they just won almost every game, and they ended up winning the pennant all in that last month and came in to play the Cubs, who were so great, and here are the Hitless Wonders of the White Sox, where nobody thought anything about them, and they beat the Cubs. And those were the days of Ed Walsh pitching, and it was
great.
Great
defense and good pitching.
Great, terrific. They had of course, Ed Walsh, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. People talk about winning 20 games. Now he won 40 games.
Did your dad talk about catching spitball pitchers?
Yes, he talked about them a lot. Well, he said that, of course, the spitball to be most effective had to be low, pitched low. But Walsh was really could control it, and he pitched it low, and catching, I'm not taking anything away from it, but I don't think there's anything especially hard about catching a spitball pitcher. The really difficult thing is to catch a knuckleball pitcher.
Do you have much experience with that?
I've had some, and it's like trying to catch a butterfly. Uh-huh. And ball players call a knuckleball a butterfly. That's because its flight pattern is about...
But you didn't have the big...
No, we didn't.
...bags or whatever they have today.
No, that's right. And that's one of the things... greatest improvements in modern-day baseball is the improvement in the gloves we have now. These catchers, of course, is making not bad catchers out of them, but none of them shift anymore. You know, they just stand there and reach over backhand instead of getting in front of the ball, and they can catch everything with one hand. And
how big is your dad's glove?
His glove was, I don't really remember.
Would yours have been bigger when you were
playing? No, mine was about the same. And ours... and took a lot of breaking in. Now they're more like a first heavy-duty first base glove with a break in the padding that allows that you to flex your fingers.
So you make a one-hand catch is like first base.
That's right. Then backhand pickups and everything like that. It's
a little easier, I guess.
Mm-hmm. If I may digress a minute, I'll tell you an interesting story about gloves. I use a Spalding glove anyway. That's neither here nor there. But it's a hard job to really break those in. It takes about a month, you know. You take a bat and you keep hitting the thing with just like a baseball, hitting it, and finally get that thing broken in to where it's comfortable and good to catch with. And you... but it doesn't flex. You always say you let it hit in there, then you cover it over with your hand. Your bare hand and held it in there. So when I was an infielder for the first several years, I was a first baseman all the way through college and everything, and so they wanted to convert me into a catcher, and I was tagging, when I first went to catching, I was tagging fellas out at home plate, and the ball, I wasn't afraid of anybody, but the ball that come in, the ball would pop out of my hand, and it was really worrying me, and I didn't know what, why or what. And one day I saw a picture taken with one of these Big Bertha telephoto cameras of Bill Dickey tagging somebody out at home plate, and I could see that he had the ball in his bare hand and then back into the glove. Instead of clapping it over the top, he had it gripped, and then in the glove was a protection. But here I was just clapping it over flat. Mm-hmm. Well, after I saw that, oh, it was just like nothing. Just got the ball, grasped it with my bare hand in the glove, and tagged him out. And it was it's funny how you find out little things like that. But getting on to tell you more about Dickie, he and I used the exact same glove, model and everything, and we both knew and we talked about it a lot. And he had helped me out on that in another incident, which I could tell you about. So we had, I felt indebted to him for the hints he gave me as an old-time catcher. And here I'm just trying to become one after I'd been an infielder there for 3 years. So I saw him late in August, I guess it was, in New York, and I said, "Well, Bill, how's everything? You're going to the World Series in a couple of weeks."
This would be in...
I don't remember which year.
31 or...
No, this would be probably, it had to be 33 or something.
You did catch a few games here in 32, it says. Five games. But
yeah, that was just a promotion deal. They did that because of the young Ed Walsh was there, and they wanted to have the sons of the old-time battery. And but that was, but I really, later on, but let me get back to Dickie. So he said somebody stole my glove. You know, on a exhibition game or something, somebody, you know how you get on the buses and all that, somebody had stolen his glove, and he was really sick about that going into the World Series in 2 weeks or a week after that. So it was my turn to be nice guy and repay him for all it did, and I went to my locker up in the clubhouse and came down and said, "Here, you can have this," and gave him one of mine, all broken in. Well,
nice. Did your dad get much for the reach patent and his...
No, I don't really know. I think I have a feeling, and this is a real feeling because after all, it was a long time ago. I think he got about $5,000, but I'm not sure. But when you look, I have an article at home I was reading that Ed Walsh, winning 40 games, was getting $3,000 a year. So you figure in those days the money aspect was a lot different than it is now. My dad managed 1 year for the White Sox, and I do know that he got $9,000 a year he managed at the White Sox.
Did he enjoy that experience? Did
he ever say? He never said, but I have a feeling he didn't. My dad is a quiet, very quiet, gentle type, and I don't think that he enjoyed being where he had to be, sometimes severe with other players. I have a feeling he wasn't comfortable doing it. Although they won more games than they lost, and they finished in the first division. But I just, that'd be my guess, would be that he would not be that comfortable.
What about growing up as the son of this?
Well, we grew up in Oregon. We moved from, you know, we're playing. Some real estate person had evidently come through the White Sox clubhouse and sold all these players' real estate out in Oregon. I don't know why, but anyway, we moved out there and we had an orchard, and our orchard was named Home Plate Orchard. And then one next to it that several of the White Sox sort of syndicated up and bought was called the White Sox Orchards. That was the name of that. It's funny, way out that far away. So we grew up on the working in the orchards, like it's like growing up on a farm, except we had trees.
How many were there?
Just my brother and me.
Did he play ball?
My brother was an excellent ball player. In fact, he was captain of the Notre Dame team when the year he graduated, and he went the whole season, 39 games without an error. But he didn't think that he would hit enough, so Dad had always told us that don't go into baseball unless you feel sure that you're going to go on the big leagues and stay there. He said, there's no place to be in the minors or anything like that. So he never played, but I did. And but they also made us, not made us, but we were, it was an unwritten thing that we were going to finish our education first.
He was an older brother?
He was 4 years older.
What was his name?
Joseph Stanley Sullivan. And so we both went to Notre Dame, and I graduated, and I could have played before this, you know, but I made sure that I graduated from Notre Dame, before I joined. I'd already tried out with the White Sox, and I was signed up to join them on my graduation. And I left Notre Dame right after graduation, took a train to Washington. And this is kind of an interesting story, I think. I was very starry-eyed and, you know, really kind of scared joining the big leagues right out of college. And I arrived in Washington early in the morning, took a cab out to the Wardman Park Hotel where the White Sox were staying, and I sat around that lobby just for hours waiting. The ball players generally get up fairly late, and about 10 o'clock they would begin. I began seeing these very well-tanned, well-conditioned men walking around. I figured they were ball players, but I was too embarrassed to go up and ask them. So I didn't say anything. I just waited, and finally, at noontime, I got on a taxi cab all by myself and went all out to the Griffith Stadium in Washington. And there I went to the clubhouse and our locker room and introduced myself to Donnie Bush, who was the manager. And I'm just as excited as I can be. You know, we'll go out and have practice and everything, and I come back in, and I know that I'm not going to play for a few weeks, you know, and but now I'm really enjoying it. I'm exhilarated with all of this big league stuff. And we had the meeting before the game where the manager and the pitcher conduct the meeting, talking about how the pitcher is going to pitch to this hitter and that hitter, and how the team was supposed to play in accordance with that plan. And I'm sitting on a uniform trunk on the periphery of this meeting, just enjoying it as could be, no pressure at all. And I'm a first baseman, I told you that. Then Donnie Bush reads the lineup for today's game. He read it off. He got down Billy Sullivan, right field. I almost fell off the uniform trunk. I couldn't believe it. And who could believe it? First of all, just to put a young kid right out of school one day and the next day precipitate him into that kind of a maelstrom. And on top of that, in a position he'd never played, and completely different outfield, infield. So there I was playing right field, and Washington had almost all left-hand hitters. I think he only had one right-hand hitter. Cecil Travis, Sammy West, Joe Kuehl, everybody. And so I played, and I was no great shakes. General Crowder was pitching. And I couldn't believe I got up and batted. I couldn't believe anybody could throw the ball that hard. Just looked like an aspirin tablet coming up. And first three times up, I grounded out just weakly. And I came into the bench and I said, "Gee, that fellow's fast." And these ball players are always joking and kidding. Everybody said, "Oh, he's one of the slow pitchers up here." Anyway, the fourth time up, I hit one. I really hit a low line drive as a bullet went right straight back through the box. And it just glanced off the Crowder a little bit and still went right on into center field. And I was so excited about that, the next day I couldn't wait to get to one of these out-of-town newspaper stands to read about my hit. The Chicago papers. See, we were in Washington. I was looking for the Chicago Tribune somewhere. And I got the paper, and I got down to, it said in the ninth inning, Billy Sullivan got a scratch hit. From then on, I had no regard for newspaper writers.
Tell me about, you went to high school out in Oregon? Or?
I went to high school at a boarding school in Portland, which was called Columbia University, which was a boarding school, a high school, and 2 years of college, and it was a branch of Notre Dame. It was. So I really went, I went to high school, got my diploma, and also first year of college there, then went back to Notre Dame. Comiskey had sent my brother and young Ed Walsh all the way through Notre Dame as a gesture of appreciation for my dad and Ed Walsh, that was ahead of me by 3 years because I jumped 1 year in school. Then he wanted to send me, but I didn't want to do it because I didn't want any ties on me. You know, I didn't want to be beholden to anybody because playing in the semi-pro leagues out there, I was you know, the scouts were there and they were talking about signing me up and all, and I wanted to be free to do it, so I didn't do it. In fact, I was going to University of California and it was all set down there for a scholarship, athletic scholarship, and a job for 2 hours a day, which was going to give me some spending money. And Newt Rockne happened to come out from Notre Dame to conduct a coaching school at Oregon State College in Corvallis, and he and I went down there, and Dad got talking to Rockne, and I didn't know anything about this until afterward. Then when the conversation is over, all of a sudden I'm going to Notre Dame. Evidently Dad had talked to Rockne. Rockne said he'd work out some kind of a scholarship back there. And I went to Notre Dame, and I was secretary to the president of the college all the way through. I mean, private secretary.
What were your years at Notre Dame?
Well, I graduated my senior year in the regular college was 31. Mm-hmm. I got my AB degree. And I was taking a combination course. The fourth year of your AB was mostly law. And then I had two more full years of law after that, post-grad, and I got my law degree.
Oh, is that right?
So you see, for 3 years, I didn't think anybody else has ever had this happen. For 3 years, I never went to spring training, and I was even missing the first month of the season. In 32, I would come up from Notre Dame on weekends and pinch hit and go back to college.
So your first 2 years of Major League Ball, you were still going to
I was still
law
going
school.
To school. Mm-hmm. And I was in the third year, when I graduated my law degree, I came from graduation again, starting out on the White Sox.
You were there at some exciting football teams in Notre Dame.
Oh, great, Critio and Marchie
Jack
Schwartz
Albert.
And Brill and, yeah. Oh yeah, all of those fellows. Yeah. Marchie Schwartz is a very close friend of mine,
yeah, right.
And I liked him very much.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know Critio very well, not at all really, but he was a fine football player.
So was Ed Walsh Jr. in your class, or was he?
I forget. I think Bob Walsh, the brother, was there. I think Ed Walsh was there the first year I went there, because I couldn't play the first year you're ineligible to play on the varsity baseball. And I think Ed Walsh was pitching for them, and then my brother, of course, was playing.
Mm-hmm. So you played 3 years. Could you play when you're in law school?
No. I was already playing for the White Sox. I was a pro. And that kind of irritated me because I played the 2 years I was eligible. I couldn't play I went there as a sophomore, remember, so I couldn't play my sophomore year. You have to have 1 year of not playing, then I played junior and senior year. But then I'm playing with the White Sox, and here I've just finished with the White Sox, and I led the team in hitting, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. Like, I wanted to coach, and I'm coming back to Notre Dame, and I'm going to finish my last year in law school. I wanted to coach the baseball team. And I thought I was qualified, and they didn't even give me a look in about it, which kind of irritated me a little bit. Anyway,
who was your coach in baseball?
George Keegan.
Was he a former?
He was a great, tremendous basketball coach, and he coached the baseball team also. He was a fine coach, no problem. But I only wanted to coach the freshman team. I didn't want to coach the regular.
So you never played minor league ball then?
No. Well, I did play after 3 years. I got in a kind of a discussion or an argument or whatever you want to call it. See, I played.
Excuse me, I keep leaning over here because this tape doesn't shut off automatically. You have to look at it, see when
right.
It stops.
Anyway, if I'll backtrack a little bit, when I signed the White Sox, Dad told me exactly what to ask for and how to phrase it and everything else. And so when all these scouts would call me, I'd read this off exactly as he told me, and I could still see it. I wanted $25,000 to sign. I want a 2-year contract at $1,000 a month and no reduction in salary if farmed out, just like that. $25,000 in those days was like a million. Anyway, so I signed with the White Sox and got a 2-year contract. But he only gave me $10,000 to sign. Harry Grabner is a very smart businessman. And And so I had this 2-year contract at $1,000 a month, which is just what I asked for. And a 3-year contract. That's right, 3-year contract. All right, now I, but no, 2-year contract, but $10,000 to sign. But he insisted on paying the $10,000 in 3 installments, $3,300, $3,300, and then $3,400 each year. You see, well, I didn't think of it at the time, but it came on me all of a sudden later on. Like the second year, as I said, I led the White Sox in hitting, and I had a fine year. And so now I'm all set to, I think I'm going to get some good salary coming up. But now I'm cut off because I have to report the third year to get that final $3,400 of the $10,000 to sign. So he wouldn't give me any raise at all. And I was real irritated about that, and being, you know, college kids are kind of uppity. I thought, well, least I can do, at least if you're going to be that niggardly about it, I'm not going to catch. On top of that, they wanted me to catch, and I figured, why should I catch? They wanted to, you know, become a catcher. Why should I do that? I've had a fine year. Why should I prejudice what I'm doing, and on top of that, not get a raise after leading the team in hitting? So I held out, and I finally made them put it in the contract. Yes, I'd sign for no raise, but I wouldn't catch. Wouldn't have to catch. Written right in the contract. Well, that kind of galled them, but so but the reason for that was Fonseca was made the manager, and Fonseca felt that he was the only place he could. Fonseca was the manager. He was an outfielder, and he felt that as at his age that he could only navigate properly at first base, because that's where big fellas can fit in without hurting you too much in the field. So he decided he's going to play first base, which is what I thought I should be playing. And then he said, well, if you're not going to catch, you're not going to play. And if you look in the records, I hardly ever played. And I hit 195 or something
that
year.
1933. Yeah. 1933. Played 54
games. Hardly played at all, and hit 195. And here the year before, I'm playing every game and led the team in hitting, which is sort of ridiculous. But that shows you how things like that'll happen, and it just upset me to death. So that's how catching thing started.
Did you play first base at Notre Dame?
Yes, that's all I ever played all my life, and through Notre Dame. I'll tell you a little interesting anecdote about that, if I may digress a minute. I was just a kid right out of school, and I had my glove that I had bought at the sporting goods store, and the first base glove in South Bend at Notre Dame there. And we were taking infield practice in the White Sox Park, and Jimmy Fox, we were playing the Athletics, and Jimmy Fox was first baseman for the Athletics. He was standing there in the coach's box waiting to take his place as soon as we finished our infield practice. As I threw my glove down, he picked it up, and he had his own glove under his arm, and he put my glove on, because this big mass of muscles that looked like a motorman's glove on, which is what he called it. And he said, hey, kid, come here. And I said, yes. I don't think I said Mr. Fox, but I said, came over. And he said, this is not the kind of glove we use up here. This is too small. And I said, well, that's the only kind I could find in the sporting goods store in South Bend. He said, well, we use lots of bigger gloves. He said, this is the kind of glove you should use. And he handed me his. And he said, try that on. Oh, it was a great, big, wonderful glove. And I said, well, that's some glove. I'll remember that. And then I went on and changed my shirt. And that's enough of that day. The next day I came out there, and here's Jimmy Fox again, and I'm out there again with my little glove. He said, hey, kid, come here. And he handed me a perfectly great, big glove, just like his, all broken in and everything. He says, keep it. He said, that's the kind of gloves we use up here. Isn't that a nice thing? It shows you the camaraderie and there's a kinship among ballplayers. Even though they compete bitterly, there still is a intrinsic loyalty to each other.
I've heard so many stories about young players coming up being given kind of a cold shoulder by the veterans.
I never saw that, ever.
They don't give them too much help or guidance in how to play, or because they feel they might be competing for their jobs.
Well, that's true, but I've even seen fellows that are right on your own team. And really, I must say that they really try to help a player. There might be instances where a fellow is sort of fresh and cocky and all that. Well, they wouldn't give him the time of day, naturally. But I never saw any young player that showed that he wanted to learn and even asked for some advice. They just gave it lavishly and willingly. Really, it's one of the things I noticed most of all in baseball.
Did your dad have any interest in your being a catcher?
No, nothing specially. No. He always thought I should have stayed at third base. At third base, I forgot to tell you that when I first joined the White Sox, I told you I joined them in Washington, and I related that about all of a sudden playing right field. And then we left Washington that night, and we went to New York, and I'm in right field again, and that awe-inspiring Yankee Stadium playing against Babe Ruth and Gehrig, all those fellas, and scared to death anyway, and I'm pinching myself out there in right field, which I'm totally unfamiliar with, and all these big names and big ball players, and they hit about 10 home runs over my head that day. I just watched them go over. But we went back home, and then I didn't play much. I pinch hit. I think I got 6 or 7 straight pinch hits, and they had to do something with me. We had a fine first baseman named Lou Blue, who was a left-hand thrower and a fine ball player, a fine gentleman. Well, they weren't going to take him off of there and put me on. They decided that they ought to put me somewhere, so they put me at third base, which was a totally new position to me, and I didn't get started till July, but I caught up with everybody in errors. I think I had 24 errors, all throwing errors, because I wasn't used to throwing to a base. First base, you're catching all the time. They're coming to you all the time. And besides that, you don't know how fast the runners run and all that. So I played third base that every day, the whole summer. I played, and 4 days before the season was over, I was hitting 291 or something. I was almost hitting 300. Which is, I was kind of proud of, coming right off of school. I ended up hitting 275, I think. I went 4 games without a hit.
Did they take advantage of you, bunting and things like that?
The third base?
No.
It worked out fine. Mm-hmm. I was, but as I say, I wasn't used to throwing, to timing the first base and getting there and all that.
We're speaking about Bill Dickey a moment ago, and wasn't that the time that Carl Reynolds, were you with him?
I was with, Carl Reynolds was with us, with the White Sox, and I got in a fight, and Reynolds, I believe, I'm a little vague on this, but Carl Reynolds had his jaws wired together with wires here, and he had to eat through a straw. He was with us at that time.
Dickey was seemed like a gentleman.
He was a very mild, wonderful fellow, and so was Carl Reynolds. But you know, this is a heat of battle, and when somebody does something maybe a little more aggressively than you think he should do, it's instinct to react, and I don't know why I didn't see that, but I remember very well Carl Reynolds having all his wiring in his mouth.
Was Smead Jolly with him then?
Yes.
Do you have any Smead Jolly stories?
Oh, I can tell you Smead Jolly stories. You really struck a nerve there, because he's such a wonderful guy. And Smead Jolly, remember now, I'm getting back to the White Sox in my very first year, and I'm just a raw kid. I'm 20 years old, I think, or 19 anyway, just right off the campus of Notre Dame. And we had a poor team. I think we finished last in the White Sox. And in the locker room, you know, there's weird chairs in front of the lockers. And Smee Jolly dressed exactly next to me, to my right. And then there was a little L-shape of two lockers this way. And the manager, Donnie Bush, and Mike Kelly, I think was the coach, were right there, and those two. So if I leaned back, I would have bumped into Donnie Bush. And Smee Jolly's on my right. Well, on a losing ball team, everybody has to play perfectly in the game, or you don't win the game. In other words, you don't win all the perfectly played games, but if you don't play them perfectly, you lose them. And so anybody does something wrong, that's terrible. You know, on a winning team, probably made a lot of mistakes and was all just lost in the shuffle. But so we'd be up there after the game, and Donnie Bush had these real bushy eyebrows, and he's a fiery little devil, wonderful guy, but fiery. And we get there, and he'd turn around in his chair and hit me on the shoulder, and he'd just really lie to me, "You lost that game, you lost that game," and I probably did. I mean, whatever I'd done was wrong, but he just ripped me to death. And I'd be leaning over like this, and Smee Jolly was dressing right next to me, and he'd be leaning over untying his ball shoes. And then when Donnie Bush finished laying me out, he got on Smee, and he said, "You lost that game," just like he'd get me. He really lit into him, and Smee Jolly would just kind of, still leaning over, kind of turn toward me a little bit and wink at me, like going off of, like water off a duck's back. It didn't bother him at all. Oh, Smee was a wonderful, what a hitter. We played in Boston. They had an out to the fence. It was sort of a hill out in left field, and then the fence started up the top of the hill. They've changed it now. They got that big fence, but in the old days, that it was sort of a hill there, and then the fence started on top of it. And the hill had a little slope, about 10 or 12 feet of dirt with a little angle. You could run up it if you got a good start. So they had Smee Jolly out there trying to, they're hitting fungos to him. They're trying to get him to go up that hill and catch the balls and run up it. He was running up after them until he got tired. We got out there one morning. They're trying to do that. So then the game started, and Smead went running up the hill after a fly ball, and he got up the top of the hill, and then he saw it was going to come back, land more near the bottom, so he started down after it, and he tumbled and fell over himself. And of course, Donnie Bush, after the game, lit into him about that. He said, Smead turned to him, and he said, "Donnie," he says, "you spent all morning teaching me how to get up that hill, but you didn't tell me how to get him down it." Then another time, he was on second. He was hitting. He was a rather slow runner, but he lashed a single out over first base somewhere, and he made the turn at first base. He made it too far. He was going to go to second base, but he had no chance at all. They had him by 30 feet. He's standing out. He was caught so far out. He stopped in the middle. He came out and tagged him. And Donnie lit into him about that, and he said, "Smead," he said, "what in the world were you thinking about out there?" He said, "You know, Donnie," he said, "that's the same thing that went through my mind." He said, "there I was in the middle, and I was saying to myself, Smead, what are you doing out here?"
His humor is just really natural.
I mean, that's right. It was just a dry. No, he wasn't being funny. Oh, another one. I think I may be a little wrong about this, but I don't think I am. You can check in the records, but it stands in my mind that we were playing in Cleveland, and this is just the time when all the trading deadline, you know, and all the rumors are going around that this fellow's going to be traded to Boston, this one to New York, and all that. And the ball players are almost afraid to send out their laundry to really be gone before it gets back. But we were in the Holland and Hotel in Cleveland, and they had kind of pillars up there, round pillars, you know, decorative pillars. And there's a group of ball players there, and I think it was Smead, I'm pretty sure. They're saying, "Well, Smead, see, you're going to, there's rumors you're going to be traded to Boston." He said, "Not me." He said, "They're not going to trade me to Boston." He said, "If they trade me to Boston, I'll quit. I'm going home." And right then, Lou Barber, who was the secretary of the club, came around from the other side of the pillar. He had an envelope in his hand. He said, "Smead," he said, "we just traded you to Boston." Smead says, "Goodbye, fellas."
it really helped, I suppose, in the team having the problems you had, having us meet around was a real loosener upper.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful to have somebody that has a light touch like that. Yeah. He just, what a hitter.
I had another question I wanted to ask you about your law. Did you ever practice law?
Oh, I didn't intend to practice it. Never wanted. I just did this to, this was my folks' ideal that both of us would graduate and both of us would go to law school and graduate and everything and have that in your pocket, so to speak. So I did that out of respect for the way they wanted to do it. In fact, my mother's dying wish when I was a junior in the regular college, sure, Billy finishes his law school. So I never intended to practice it, but I knew it was a good education. And to me, it is a marvelous education. I never intended to practice, but it's wonderful training, and I begrudge it at all.
Had your father and mother had college work?
No. My father had high school education and was well-educated from that standpoint. My mother came over from Ireland. Her name was Molly O'Sullivan, incidentally. She came over from Ireland when she was 18 and went directly to Mercy Hospital in Chicago, which at that time was the largest hospital there, and went into nurse's training and got the highest average that anybody had ever gotten there in training, and she became superintendent of the hospital. As a matter of fact, Dad, who's a big star of the White Sox, came into that hospital for an operation, and all the fans and all were coming in to see him and all that, and the nurse on the floor couldn't handle that and couldn't get the people to leave, and my mother was superintendent. She went up there and she got them all out right, bang, they moved when she talked, and that's when Dad met her.
Exactly.
Yeah, they got there. But so she had that kind of an education. A boarding school at Loretta Academy in Dublin, Ireland, and then the nurses training and a good record there.
Being a college man, at a time, and there weren't too many of them in baseball, I guess the number was growing, but was that, that caused people to look at you in any different way?
Some of the not especially, not especially. There, if you were a college fella and you wore it like a uniform or something, that you were a college man, I'm sure it would have been terrible. But you make your own ways. How people react to you, how you react to them. And I didn't think any more of being a college fellow than not being a college fellow to make the slightest bit of difference to me.
It's so, old story about Tim Hurst, the old umpire in American League, once he got in a row with Eddie Collins or vice versa, and he spit on Eddie Collins, and Van Johnson fired him for that. But Van said, "Tim, why did you do it?" And Tim said, "Van, I just don't like college kids."
Speaking of Eddie Collins, if I digress a minute, we played, he was a coach for the athletics for Connie Mack, and he was third base coach. And remember, I'm playing third base. So I always try to play every angle. I think if you're a professional athlete, you try to get every last little edge you can get, or you're not a pro. So any third base is anchored down with a strap. There's a spike, a big spike in the ground, and there's a strap that holds the base there. Well, almost any base has a little play in it. You can move it back and forth a couple of inches. So whenever I went from our dugout, which was on the third base side, out to take, you know, when we were in the field, I always kicked that bag inward about 2 inches or 3 inches, whatever amount of slack there was in it, because I was gaining that much, the ball being, they had to, you know, it would be a foul ball by about 2 inches. Well, Collins would come out, and he was always going to the third base coaching box there, and he'd kick it back, and I'd, when he wasn't looking, I'd kick it the other way. He really got mad at me.
About 34, that was after your problem with Lou.
Oh, I never did finish that. Did I?
What happened in 34?
I told you they wanted me to catch, and I wouldn't catch. And I, so all I had, I hit 195. They sent me to Milwaukee. And And I went up there and I played third base all year with Milwaukee, every game. And I got the most hits in the league. I had 223 hits. Hit 343.
And you got the title?
I didn't have the highest batting average. I had a good batting average, yeah. But a fellow named George Washington hit more than I did. His batting average, he was a wonderful hitter. But I got the most hits. I had 223 hits, which is a lot of hits.
Who was the manager in Milwaukee?
How could I not? Oh, my favorite manager of all time, Al Southern.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, what? I'd do anything with that man. And I want to tell you something about him.
Excuse me just a moment. Could we get you some coffee?
No, thank you. I just had a lot of coffee before.
A lot of talking here.
No, if you want it, fine. No, I just came from having about 5 cups of coffee. Okay. But I want to tell you about Al Southern. And I just love that man. And he had the perfect approach. Any young, especially young ball players, need to be patted on the back and kind of brought along that way. Well, you can't really rip an old ball player like Smee Jolly, like I said, it went off him like water off a duck's back. But a young player has to be, in a friendly, fatherly way. So Al Southern would get me after the ball game up there, and he'd sit me down and he'd say, "Billy, you really know baseball. You've got a great grounding in baseball." And he said, "Your father, because you were with him, you know the game. You really know the game." And now, while the anesthesia is setting in, he says, "You know too much baseball to make a play like you made today." Huh. You see the difference, the psychological approach? And I'd do anything for that man. And it was a delightful year. I just played my heart out for him. I hollered so much. I'm a holler guy, that I could hardly whisper when I'd go home at night. And I wouldn't trade that year for anything. And as I said, of course, it worked out. Getting the most hits in the league, 223 hits, and not very many games. So, they played less games. Yeah. Though,
about 140 game season.
There's a fellow in this town that was on that team with me, George Soucy. He lives down here. George Soucy was a catcher for us in Milwaukee. He could.
Do you think he'd mind being interviewed?
No, he'd love it. He's been hanging on in baseball ever since, as coach and everything. He lives down here in Shepherd, one of the streets right up here, not more than a mile from here.
Well, then Cincinnati by